The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
This is the second part of the preface of Death in Houston High Society. If you haven't listened to part one, much of the following won't make a lot of sense, so we encourage you to do so before proceeding. While the murder of Jacques Mosler isn't a Texas crime, the man was a Houston-based businessman at the time of his death, and his wife Candy makes an appearance in the story of the subject of this series, a man some call the Bluebeard of Houston. Candy Weatherby Johnson met multimillionaire businessman Jacques Mosler in the fall of 1948 while soliciting donations for the New Orleans Grand Opera Company. Jacques and Candy hit it off immediately and began a whirlwind romance. They were married just 6 months later and settled down in a large mansion in an upscale part of Houston, Texas. For years, Candy and Jacques had a happy marriage. They adopted 4 children who were orphaned in Chicago, Illinois, after they'd undergone a set of horrific circumstances, to put it lightly. Jacques' finance business became more successful each year. But when a 19-year-old man named Melvin Lane Powers, or Mel, came to town, everything came crashing down. In 1961, Mel had gotten into a little trouble in Pontiac, Michigan, for scamming an elderly widower out of thousands of dollars. Mel, Candy's older sister's son, came to his Aunt Candy's home in Houston to get straight and stay out of trouble, but trouble instead followed him. Mel and Aunt Candy, 22 years his senior, began a passionate and incestuous love affair not long after he moved into the Mosler mansion. Jacques Mosler found out and had Mel Powers removed from his home by authorities. He was sickened, embarrassed, and angry. But Jacques couldn't divorce Candy unless he wanted to lose half of everything he owned. It was bad enough the scandal had become the talk of Houston's high society, and even worse, inside the walls of many banks and financial firms he owned. So, in late 1963, Jacques retreated to his apartment on Florida's Key Biscayne to get his head straight and strategize his next move. Not to mention, get away from Candy. Unfortunately, Jacques was also losing time with his beloved children. But in late May of 1964, Candy brought the kids to the tropical Florida barrier island for a visit with their father. The kids would be heading to Switzerland for boarding school at the end of the summer. Not long after they arrived, Candy began experiencing debilitating migraine headaches, she says. Each time she visited Miami's Jackson Memorial Hospital for treatment, she brought all the children with her, and it was late at night, in the pre-dawn hours. But the details surrounding the last time she went to that particular hospital for her headaches are odd, if not wildly suspicious, because that same night, Jacques Mosler was violently and passionately murdered. Candy Mosler and the kids left Jacques' apartment around midnight on June 29, 1964, to head back to the beachside hotel they'd checked into. At a little before 1:20 a.m., now Tuesday, June 30th, Candy Mosler loaded her and her husband's children up in her red convertible. Candy drove to the DuPont Plaza Hotel in downtown Miami, where, according to her, she bought stamps and mailed some letters. From there, she and the children went to Jackson Memorial Hospital because Candy was having migraines and needed immediate treatment. They were at Jackson Memorial for about 2 hours, and in that time, Candy received 3 phone calls from a man identifying himself as a family member. The caller was not Jacques Mosler, one nurse later confirmed, nor could it have been. After Candy and the kids left the hospital, they headed to Jacques's home at the Governor's Lodge Apartments on Key Biscayne. They entered at 4:30 a.m. The children were horrified at what they discovered. These are the same children who'd awakened to the sound of gunshots in 1957 when their father shot their mother to death and were forced to stay in the home with her bloodied body for nearly 2 days. Their father also killed their baby brother. Jacques Mosler had saved them from a life in children's homes, and now their adopted father laid on the living area floor in a pool of blood. The orange blanket that covered him was soaked crimson. Oddly, Candy's daughter from another marriage, Rita, was instructed by her mother to phone Jacques' Florida physician before calling the police. Dr. John Handworker's phone rang at 4:45 a.m., and his answering service informed him of the medical emergency at Jacques' apartment. The answering service transferred the distraught Rita's call to Dr. Handworker. Rita told the doctor that someone had broken in and beaten her stepfather badly, and she didn't think he was alive. There was so much blood. Dr. Handworker got out of bed and began getting dressed. He asked Rita if the police had been called, and she told him they had not. The doctor, of course, thought that was strange, but he told her he'd call. They hung up, and Dr. Handworker did just that. A slow night, Dade County Sheriff's Deputy Jim Jorgensen arrived not 5 minutes after the doctor called the department at 4:53 a.m. When Candy answered the apartment door, Deputy Jorgensen asked where he could find Jacques. She gestured toward the living room near the large glass doors that led to the balcony. Dispassionately, the deputy later said, Candy told him,
"He's over there."
As he passed, the deputy noticed Jacques' boxer, Rocky, leashed to a kitchen doorknob. He approached Jacques, and there was no mistaking the man was dead. The amount of blood was shocking. Next to Jacques laid a heavy glass swan sculpture that was partially shattered. Deputy Jorgensen began looking around the apartment for clues. On the kitchen countertop, he found 2 highboy glasses. In one, 3 cigarettes had been extinguished. The kitchen sink showed clear-cut signs of blood diluted by water, and along with that, a wet, bloody hand towel. It was obvious Jacques' killer had cleaned up there. Not far away was a palm print. When Dr. Handworker arrived, he checked Jacques for a pulse. It was just a formality at that point, just in case, but the doctor knew what he'd find before he even tried. He lifted the blanket and saw that Jacques wore only a nightshirt. In one of Jacques' hands was a hair. It appeared to have been dyed jet black. After hours of processing the scene, detectives were met by a slew of reporters outside the governor's lodge. The story was sure to be a front-page sensation, simply for the fact of where it happened. But no one at that point really knew what lay in store. Later that same day, an autopsy was performed on the body of Jacques Mosler. Dade County Medical Examiner Dr. Joseph Davis all but immediately noticed a bloody handprint on the body. In fact, he'd noticed it at the scene when he arrived at about 10 till 6 that morning. But that was something for investigators. He was more focused on the brutal nature of the injuries, the overkill. Jacques was bludgeoned on the head at least 2 times. The back of his skull was crushed, his left cheekbone shattered. Investigators at the scene thought those injuries were inflicted by the glass swan that was found near the body, but Dr. Davis determined that the item wasn't heavy or sturdy enough to cause such damage. It had likely just fallen during the scuffle. The injuries instead were likely caused by what Davis described as an oversized soda bottle, which is where the shards of green glass found at the scene were thought to have originated. Defense wounds riddled Jacques's arms and hands. On the left side of Jacques's chest, Dr. Davis found 17 stab wounds. 6 more wounds were found to the left, though nearer to the man's heart. Jacques was stabbed twice in the center of his breastbone, and finally a thrust directly into the middle of his heart. After all the wounds were cataloged, they totaled 39, and 6 had penetrated the heart. Jacques had been stabbed many times before the orange blanket was laid atop him, and several times after the orange blanket was laid atop him. The time of death, Dr. Davis determined, was between 1:30 and 2 a.m. Theories weren't hard to come by for investigators. Jacques Mosler was extraordinarily rich, and with wealth comes both the potential for robberies and sometimes business relationships and transactions gone bad. Since $550 was missing from Jacques' wallet, robbery was a possibility, and since Jacques' various companies were forced to repossess property in which payments were far behind on, perhaps a disgruntled customer was responsible for the slaying. But considering the vengeful passion with which Jacques Mosler was killed, the overkill, detectives couldn't help but doubt such theories, even while working them. This crime seemed to be highly personal. But after locating a mysterious car and interviewing the man's widow, the pieces began falling into place. Immediately after responding, Dade County deputies and investigators finished inspecting the scene of the murder of multimillionaire businessman Jacques Mosler. They scoured the Governor's Lodge apartments in search of witnesses. Keep in mind, that night at 1:20 a.m., Candy Mosler, the victim's wife, visited a Miami hotel to buy stamps and send letters, she says, and then went directly to the hospital for treatment for migraine headaches. At 1:45 a.m., several of Jacques' neighbors were awakened by the dramatic and ferocious barks originating from his terrace. The individual who lived directly above Jacques hollered for him to shut the dog up, to which he heard a man's voice reply that he was bringing him inside. This was immediately followed by loud thuds and muffled groans, also a strange, unrecognized man's voice. Heard also was what sounded like the desperate cries of a man in trouble.
"Don't,"
the man cried out.
"Don't do that to me."
Shortly after that, heavy footsteps were heard hurrying down the stairwell toward the building's exit. It sounded like something was terribly wrong, and 3 of Jacques' neighbors rushed to his apartment and knocked. No one answered, and the noises had ceased, so they all went back home. But some neighbors actually saw a suspicious man. The man was tall, husky, had dark hair, and wore dark clothing. He was seen walking to the parking lot, and moments later, a white Chevrolet pulled out and drove away with its headlights off. During and after all of these events, no one called the cops. Jacques Mosler served during World War I. After his funeral at Riverside Memorial Chapel on Thursday, July 2, 1964, he was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. Though theories of robbery and bad business transactions were being floated around, the cops just couldn't get past the savage overkill. A murder victim's spouse is often the first person a detective will check out. It's standard procedure to start in the middle of the circle and work your way out. And the police were acting fast. Candy Mosler's alibi was checked out. Police discovered she was at Jackson Memorial Hospital that night, or early morning, having checked in at 2:06 a.m. and out at 4:05 a.m. But detectives were hardly satisfied with the woman's strange alibi, this seemingly created alibi. Later on the day of the murder, Dade County Sheriff's investigators met with Candy at her hotel room. She'd already hired a lawyer who was present. Candy went on about her belief that her husband was killed as the result of a robbery or burglary gone wrong. There were thousands of dollars worth of jewelry missing, she told detectives. When asked for a detailed list of those valuable items, Candy's lawyer told the cops she was in no state to do that at the moment. And apparently, she never was, as no such list was ever made. The detectives told Candy that they had another theory, that Jacques' slaying was a crime of passion, a methodically planned out crime of passion. At that statement, she quickly changed her tune about the robbery thing. Candy, in fact, came up with a whopper. After his terrible respiratory illness in 1962, her husband changed, she told detectives. Jacques, Candy said, would often come waltzing in the house with strange men he'd invited over for a drink. He'd brag about his wealth to sleep with them, Candy told detectives, and though the change in Jacques deeply hurt her, she'd been keeping the secret of his male lovers away from public and business scrutiny. Often, and with many, Jacques would heatedly quarrel with these men, Candy told the cops. It's unclear if Dade County investigators ever believed these allegations, but they certainly checked into it later. Not a single person who knew the man corroborated the recently widowed woman's claims. The cops soon found out about three phone calls made to the Jackson Memorial Hospital asking for Candy Mosler on the night of the murder, the caller identifying themselves as a family member. She had not received any phone calls at all on her previous visits there for migraine treatments, which occurred on June 24th and June 26th. Authorities were not aware at this point of the relationship between Candy Mosler and her nephew, but after the palm print lifted from the murder scene was ran through the FBI's national database, knowledge of such became inevitable. The feds called authorities in Dade County, Florida at about 9 p.m. on June 30th, 1964, and told them they found a match to the print. It belonged to a guy named Melvin Lane Powers, the FBI said. Looking at Mel became investigators' next order of business. Dade County Sheriff's Department investigators learned that Mel Powers took a flight from Houston, Texas, to Miami, Florida on June 29, 1964, arriving at his destination just hours before the murder of Jacques Mosler. At around 7 p.m., Mel ordered a double scotch at the Stuffed Shirt Lounge, a bar in the Holiday Inn just off the Rickenbacker Causeway, which serves traffic to and from Key Biscayne and Miami. While sipping on his drink, Mel asked for a king-sized bottle of Coca-Cola, empty. It was a strange request, but the bartender had seen weirder. The man struck him odder than the order. He was kind of rude, dressed in all black, and left no tip after quickly consuming his scotch. Mel left behind the empty Coke bottle. He returned to the Stuffed Shirt at about 12:30 a.m., now June 30th, well within a couple hours of the murder of Jacques Mosler. Again, Mel Powers asked for a double scotch. He killed it quick and asked the bartender where the hotel's payphones were located. The cops had been looking for a white Chevy. They found the car within hours of the discovery of Jacques' body, parked at the airport conveniently within a few short steps of the sheriff's substation there. This car entered the airport at 5:19 a.m., not long before it was found. Mel Powers took a flight back to Houston just after that. This car was a white 1960 Chevrolet Impala. Though Candy Mosler only ever mentioned the red convertible Chrysler she'd borrowed from one of Jacques' Miami loan companies, this car was a repo. She never mentioned to detectives the white Chevrolet she'd had delivered to her. Investigators found out about it quick after paying a visit to the loan company, again within hours of the discovery of Jacques' body. In fact, they'd confronted Candy about it during the visit detectives paid her I mentioned above. Candy told them she knew nothing about the car after she had the company take it back. Candy, of course, never mentioned Mel during that interview, but just hours after the FBI matched the palm print from Jacques' apartment to Melvin Powers, the cops matched fingerprints to those found in the white 1960 Chevy Impala to the man as well. Anyway, it didn't really matter what Candy had to say at that point, as detectives were laser-focused on Mel. Witnesses who had seen the man in black fleeing the scene of Jacques Mosler's murder couldn't identify him as Mel Powers by a 1961 Pontiac, Michigan mugshot, nor could they identify the 1960 white Chevy Impala. Both could have been what they saw, they told detectives, but none of the witnesses would say they were positive. When detectives tracked down Jacques' longtime driver and handyman, Roscoe Brown, he told them that Candy still had the white Chevy Impala the day of the murder. He'd also seen Mel Powers with Candy when he delivered the car to her at the Miami International Airport about a week prior. After Candy and Mel dropped off Roscoe at the garage where Mosler's company kept the repos, Candy told the loyal employee not to tell anyone that he'd seen Mel. On Friday, July 3, 1964, Dade County, Florida Sheriff's Department investigators boarded a plane to Houston, Texas, just after determining at a meeting that took place at headquarters that Melvin Lane Powers was their guy. Meanwhile, and in cahoots with Florida detectives, Texas Rangers visited Mel at his business office and arrested him for an outstanding warrant on a traffic offense from Calhoun County. Clothing confiscated from Mel, the stuff he was wearing when he came back from Miami, had traces of blood. On July 4th, while the rest of the country was celebrating Independence Day, Melvin Lane Powers was being booked into a Harris County jail. The charge was first-degree murder.
"Oh, pooh, that's absolutely ridiculous,"
Candy Mosler responded when she learned of the arrest of her nephew and lover, Melvin Lane Powers. But she sure acted fast. She and Mel's mother, Candy's big sister Elizabeth, sought out the man who was arguably the best defense attorney in the United States at the time, Percy Forman. Going into Forman is too big an undertaking for our purposes here, but the man has represented everyone from James Earl Ray, the guy who killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., to Jack Ruby, albeit briefly, the guy who gunned down the alleged assassin of President John F. Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, while he was surrounded by Dallas cops. The son of a Texas sheriff knew that representing Mel Powers would be both financially rewarding and further his already strong standing as a national celebrity. But Candy Mosler couldn't pay the man right away. With Jacques' murder, she didn't have access to the $200,000 retainer hiring the great Percy Forman set you back. So Forman accepted a box full of fine jewelry as a collateral, diamonds, emeralds, and gold, all gifts given to Candy over the years by her slain husband. After Mel's arrest, the cops got warrants to search his property. During the execution of those warrants, they found photos and love letters to nephew Mel from Aunt Candy.
"You mean the whole world to me, and I love and want you more than I can tell you,"
Candy proclaimed in one letter. The postscript of another read,
"It is cold here. I'd like you to keep me ever so warm."
The entire picture was coming together, and Candy Mosler skipped town fast. She checked herself into the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, for an indefinite stay, citing both her debilitating migraines and some other undisclosed conditions for her hospitalization. Candy took the children with her, and meanwhile, both Texas and Florida investigators worked at a feverish pace putting the pieces of the puzzle together. It took a year, in fact, for the state of Florida to get their case together, and that's with all hands on deck. Neighbors, Mosler Company employees, and clerks from various hotels were all added to the witness list. These folks had all seen various forms of affection between Candy and Mel. Newspapers nationwide had gotten wind of what seemed in the moment to be the most sensational story of the 20th century. Candy denied any love affair between her and her nephew to the press in a bedside interview. But the cops weren't buying it, and they were positive that A. Melvin Lane Powers brutally murdered Jacques Mosler, and B. Candy was in on the whole damn thing, probably the mastermind. Nothing made that clearer than the strong circumstantial evidence investigators had collected, not to mention the forensic evidence, the fingerprints, and the palm print. But there was also the matter of Jacques' diary. In it, the millionaire businessman wrote about fearing for his life because Candy and Mel were out to kill him. Anyway, Dade County authorities charged Candy Mosler with murder and put out a warrant for her arrest in July of 1965. Instead of having a big scene made in Rochester, the indignity of a surprise arrest, Candy agreed to travel to Miami to surrender to police. When she arrived at Miami International, accompanied by a nurse, a state police commander was waiting to arrest her. Candy smiled for pictures as the press bombarded the path to the police cruiser. She was all smiles as she told the press that the police should be looking for the real killer and that this farce was what taxpayer money paid for. Bizarrely, Candy went on,
"This is Russia. They would convict Jesus Christ."
Soon, both Candy and Mel were out on bail after paying $50,000 bonds each. It would be months before the trial began, and both sides worked their cases hard. Meanwhile, the press was preparing for the sensational shit show they knew the proceedings would be. And they were right, thanks mostly to defense attorney Percy Foreman. Even before the trial, Foreman had Mel's supposed confession thrown out. Miranda warnings were virtually brand new, and the detectives present hadn't read the accused his rights. This apparent confession was weak, from what I understand, and could have easily been argued away as Mel just trying to get the cops off his back. Melvin Lane Powers never explicitly said, "I killed Jacques Mosler," apparently. But now, anyway, it didn't matter. I'm not going to go in depth on the trial of Candy Mosler and Melvin Lane Powers. It was ultimately decided the two would be tried together, which might have been the main reason for the outcome, though much of that credit certainly goes to Percy Foreman. Anyway, much of what we've already covered was stuff that came out in court. The trial began on January 16, 1966, to a packed courtroom. For fear they'd lose their seat, spectators brought their lunch so they didn't have to get up. The judge in the trial was known for his puritanism, for lack of a better word, and closed the proceedings to all under the age of 21 due to the sexual and incestuous nature he knew the proceedings would be. During the trial, Candy's dramatic and manipulative antics were on full display as she dabbed a pink handkerchief filled with ice cubes on her forehead, was excused from court many times for either headaches, nausea, or fainting, and on several occasions still showed up for proceedings wearing a neck brace. Her defense attorney didn't like her leaving the court when such spells arose. Once, when she left the court to vomit, Percy Foreman chastised her.
"God damn you," he scolded. "When you have to get sick in the future, do it in front of the jury."
Judge Schultz once demanded to her lawyers that Candy sit up and not lay across two chairs during trial. The state's case was doomed from the start. Mel's supposed confession, of course, had already been suppressed, as had Candy's diary and a 9-page letter that Mel wrote Candy while in jail. But the state did call many witnesses who swore to the couple's relationship, and that includes two men who worked directly alongside Mel. They told the court about the man bragging of his sexual control over Candy. The state laid into the defendants and their incestuous affair, accusing them of plotting the slaying of Jock Mosler in order to inherit his millions and gain control of his extraordinarily successful businesses. Four witnesses who claimed Candy Mosler had attempted to hire them to kill Jacques were called, two of which were ex-cons, and the other two wore prison jumpsuits into court as they were currently incarcerated. The defense made short work of all these men in the eyes of the jury. The circumstantial evidence against Melvin Lane Powers was as strong as it gets, really. And I'd argue the same for Candy and her behavior in the days leading up to Jacques' murder, and even after. Mel's palm print found in the apartment of Jacques Mosler and his fingerprints in the Chevy Impala, however, was the strongest forensic evidence they had. Defense attorney Percy Foreman provided the jury with plenty of reasonable doubt as far as the fingerprints, challenging the state's fingerprint expert witness to admit that there was no way to tell when the fingerprints were made. Since Mel was seen in town a week prior to the murder, the defense argued, the prints could have been left then. It wasn't just Percy Foreman on the defense team either. There were six other high-powered attorneys. But Foreman was the showboat. And juries, not just this one, always ate up Foreman's performance. And a lot of it was pretty despicable. There was plenty of gaslighting of a murdered victim. Although no witnesses could be produced to testify to such, Foreman called Jacques a homosexual in court and said he's the reason Candy had to seek companionship with her nephew. Every conceivable type of sexual perversion a person could have, Foreman said, Jacques had it. The defense attorney went on to call him a transvestite and a voyeur, a sadist and a masochist. All his words. It was a different time, I guess, but even so, Foreman's display was distasteful, dishonest, and disgusting. But it worked. In early March of 1966, after 2 months of trial, the jury deliberated for 2 days. There were issues. At first, the jury told the judge they were deadlocked, but Judge Schultz wouldn't have it and sent them right back. Finally, a verdict of not guilty came. Candy Mosler and Melvin Lane Powers were free to go. They embraced in court after the verdict was read. Jacques Mosler's will left $1 million trust funds each for his children. That includes his own, Candy's, and the kids they adopted. But Candy Weatherby Johnson Mosler got the lion's share of the man's $33 million fortune and his businesses. Melvin Lane Powers and Candy Mosler returned to Houston and for a few years lived together openly as a couple. After she said Mel beat her and tried to run her off the road, Candy filed assault charges against her nephew in 1969. Candy finally left Mel, citing to close friends that the man, 22 years her junior, was emotionally immature and prone to fits of jealous rage. Mel lived in Houston until he died in his home on October 8, 2010. By 1979, Mel had reportedly amassed a fortune of $200 million after becoming a real estate investor and builder. In fact, many substantial downtown Houston buildings that he had built still stand. Candy married a union electrician named Barnett Wade Garrison soon after she and Mel split. He was 18 years younger than her. The two seemed to be happy, friends said, but there were obviously problems. In the early morning hours of Sunday, August 13, 1972, only 13 months after they married, something terrible went down at the mansion that used to belong to Jacques Mosler. The night before, Barnett and Candy had a heated argument after getting drunk and he stormed out. He drove to some Houston nightclubs and continued drinking, After finding out his sister was using his family's Galveston Beach house, he decided he'd just go back to the mansion. The story goes like this. Barnett, for whatever reason, didn't have keys to the mansion. It's unclear why he wouldn't have a house key on his car key ring, but it's possible, I suppose. Anyway, police ascertained that Barnett knew of a third-story window that was unlocked, and he attempted to climb to it, but lost his grip and fell. For some reason, before doing so, he took off his shoes, which he was carrying as he supposedly climbed. The butler didn't find Barnett until 10 a.m. that morning. He called police, and because she could hear the sirens, Candy refused to leave her room until the butler could convince her that the sirens weren't for her. Also found near where Barnett landed was a 9mm handgun. The 30-foot fall left the man comatose for weeks. Barnett was brain damaged and suffered many broken ribs and a collapsed lung. Police decided the fall was an accident. Hell, they'd come up with a theory of what happened, and when Barnett finally came out of his coma, he had virtually no memory of that night. He remained hospitalized for 2 years. When he got out, Barnett's parents came and took him back to their home in Sugarland, Texas, and though Candy tried many times to speak with her husband, his parents would not allow it. Nor would the man's lawyers when she asked to speak with him privately, as she was divorcing him in 1975. He was fighting the divorce, but the judge granted since, he reasoned, Barnett had essentially left her. Barnett Wade Garrison died on February 3, 2009. He'd been in assisted living facilities for 25 years since leaving the hospital after the fall. But he and Melvin Lane Powers lasted far longer than Candy Weatherby Johnson Mosler Garrison did. Placidil is a sedative often prescribed for insomnia. Candy ate Placidil, it was reported, as if they were jelly beans. The odor of this drug, Dade County Medical Examiner Dr. Joseph Davis said, was overwhelming as he exposed Candy's liver at autopsy. On October 25, 1976, 56-year-old Candy flew to Miami for a board meeting. At the Fontainebleau Hotel, Candy checked herself into the penthouse just before calling her doctor over to administer migraine treatments. For the pain, she was injected with Demerol, and for nausea, Phenergan. The next morning, Candy was found lying on the penthouse's king-size bed, face down in a pillow. Deceased. Though none of the drugs in her system could be considered fatal doses, they'd caused the woman to roll over and suffocate. Neither Dr. Davis nor Chief Deputy Medical Examiner Ronald Wright had ever seen scarring such as that found on Candy's buttocks. She'd been injected so many times there that the muscle and fat wore what the examiners called rock hard. Perhaps, they estimated, 10,000 times or more over the past several years. Also noted on Candy's autopsy was a horizontal scar on her right wrist, well healed and the origin of which unknown, and silicon injected straight into her breasts, not implants, a practice illegal in the United States. But I guess with money like Candy, you can get anything you want. She had actually grown Jacques Mosler's business and was worth well over $100 million at the time of her death. Candy was buried at Arlington Cemetery beside the husband she was accused of killing. Melvin Lane Powers attended her funeral. No one has ever been held responsible for the brutal murder of Jacques Mosler. Candy will make a brief appearance next episode as we dig into the man dubbed the Bluebeard of Houston and the still unsolved murders of the women he might have killed. It's an incredible story. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, And for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Slayer Saint, the Devil of West Texas, the Odessa Lust Murders, and our latest there, the Tourniquet Killer, Parts 1 and 2, among others. Part 3's coming soon, guys, I promise. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. The Chicago Tribune, the Houston Chronicle, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Miami Sun Sentinel, True TV, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.